Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Quick check of Valley traffic, I-17 northbound, an accident on the exit ramp at Bell Road. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high today of 84. 77 is average for today. 79 was yesterday's high. Clear skies tonight with overnight lows in the mid-50s. Sunny skies both tomorrow and Thursday with highs each day right around 88 degrees. It's 80 degrees right now in Phoenix. Five Arizonans could be facing jail time in connection with a 2014 standoff with federal law enforcement over the removal of Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy's cows. KJZZ's Will Stone has more.
A grand jury recently indicted the five Arizona residents, along with more than a dozen other people from across the country, for their roles in the armed confrontation in Bunkerville, Nevada, led by rancher Cliven Bundy. Three of those arrested are from the Valley, while the other two are from Humboldt and Cottonwood. The charges include conspiracy to commit an offense against the United States government and to impede or injure a federal officer. It's alleged the defendants planned, organized, and led the assault in order to extort the officers into abandoning approximately 400 head of cattle. Many of the charges carry with them 5, 10, and even 20 years of jail time and substantial fines. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Starting in April, Lake Havasu City will switch to reclaimed water when irrigating some public parks and fields. Last week, the City Council approved a $400,000 bid to make the change. City Engineer Jeremy Abbott says the investment will ultimately save the city money and reserve drinking water for city growth.
At Rotary Park and London Bridge Beach in Lake Havasu City, about 114,000 gallons of drinkable water is used to irrigate the grounds each day. The City Council recently approved a bid to use reclaimed water for those public parks, some playing fields, and street landscaping. Lake Havasu City Engineer Jeremy Abbott says the switch frees up more drinking water for future city growth and thinks the investment is a step in the right direction for more water conservation.
It's extremely important for us to make sure that we're using the least amount of water possible, but then when we do use the water, that we're using it in the smartest way possible.
The approved bid will cost the city about $400,000. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A legal fight could be in the future between the city of Phoenix and the state of Arizona. Mayor Greg Stanton has called an executive session to explore options to prevent a bill signed by Governor Doug Ducey from taking effect. At issue is the creation of a business improvement district for Roosevelt Row. KJZZ's business correspondent Christina Estes has been covering the story and joins me now. Christina, why is the mayor upset?
He sees this as an attempt to block action taken by the city council just 2 months ago. That's when they voted to create the Roosevelt Business Improvement District. It's a special district that raises property taxes in a specific area. In this case, it's roughly 7th Street to 7th Ave from Fillmore to Moreland. The extra taxes would cover extra city services. Supporters in Roosevelt Row say they want to use it for things like marketing, beautification, and security.
Oh, Christina, we talked in January when the council approved the district, and at that time, some opponents felt they didn't get a fair say in the matter. Is that what led to this bill?
Bingo. This bill changes the statewide requirements to create a business improvement district. Right now, more than 50% of opponents have to submit a protest to stop the district from forming. So rather than opponents having to submit a formal protest, the bill that the governor signed requires a vote showing support from at least 51% of property owners.
So how do supporters like Mayor Stanton think they can keep this bill from taking effect?
Well, the changes apply retroactively to districts formed after mid-December. And guess what? Roosevelt is the only district formed since then. The Arizona Constitution bans what's described as special legislation, and Mayor Stanton sees this bill as special legislation designed to stop the Roosevelt district. So they may try to argue that the retroactive changes are unconstitutional.
What does Governor Doug Ducey have to say about this?
In a written statement we got just this morning, the governor's office said the bill does not prohibit cities from forming districts. It simply gives Arizonans the say they deserve and prevents government from imposing a tax increase against the will of the people.
That's KJZZ's business correspondent, Christina Estes. Christina, thanks.
You're welcome.
Former Mesa Mayor Scott Smith says he will not enter the GOP primary to succeed retiring Congressman Matt Semin. The 5th District encompasses the East Valley and is seen as a safe Republican seat. In a Facebook post this morning, Smith said this was not the right time for him to run for Congress and that he couldn't give a campaign his full attention, passion, and energy right now. Smith's decision leaves Senate President Andy Biggs and State Representative Justin Olson as the only candidates in the race so far. For more on this, including whether they'll stay the only candidates in the race, I'm joined by Stan Barnes, president of Comper State Consulting. Stan, first off, are you surprised Scott Smith is staying out of this primary?
Yes, I am surprised. I think the political world is surprised because Mayor Smith is a talented political figure, has proven ability to raise money, has a lot of name identification and ambition. And so I think the political world is surprised at his decision.
So Mayor Smith is out. Senate President Andy Biggs is in. State Representative Justin Olson is in. Is this the field, do you think?
I don't think so. You don't get a vacuum like this very often, even though in Matt Salmon's tenure it's happened twice because he stepped away twice. Perhaps the only congressman in all of the United States history to step away twice voluntarily from service in Congress. But it doesn't come along very often. And I think there are more ambitions out in that sweet spot of the East Valley, which is the Congressional District 5. So I expect others will jump in. I just don't know who. But this is the kind of year when people with ambition and resources are taking action. And I think that still yet remains a factor in this congressional seat.
Do you think that there were some potential candidates who were waiting to see if Scott Smith would be in or out before making their decisions?
I think every candidate who is contemplating, every potential candidate who is contemplating getting into the brawl that is a Republican primary for a congressional seat is first off wondering who else is in the race. And it would not surprise me if there are ambitious people that were waiting for Scott Smith to make a decision before they made their own decision.
What does the timing look like at this point? How much longer do potential candidates have to decide if they're going to jump in the race or not?
The timing is really questioning the ability to raise resources because you could jump in at the very last minute if you could self-fund your campaign. And the very last minute is sometime in May, I suspect, because you got to get signatures in order to qualify for the ballot, have your name on the ballot. So someone who actually needs to raise money needs to be in the race right now because it's already a very short fuse. Someone who can self-fund their campaign could wait another month or two before they jump in. That's not advisable, but there is that much space in the calendar for someone who's making a decision about getting in or not getting in.
Stan Barnes is president of Copper State Consulting and a former state lawmaker. Mexico is Arizona's biggest trading partner and one of the biggest trading partners for the country overall. This month, Arizona Senator Jeff Flake called on his Senate colleagues to approve President Obama's choice as ambassador to Mexico. But what impact does an ambassador, or lack thereof, have on trade? For the answer, I'm joined by George Hammond. He's the director of the Economic and Business Research Center in the Eller College of Management at the University of Arizona. And George, given the amount of trade between Mexico and Arizona and Mexico and the U.S., more broadly, how important is it for America to have an ambassador there?
Well, I think it's important that we have good relationships with the Mexican government, and certainly the ambassador is a key part of that. And, you know, you're right that Mexico is a key trading partner for both Arizona and the U.S. So, having a good trade relationship with Mexico is very important.
So it sounds like it doesn't necessarily negatively impact trade if there is an ambassador, but it could potentially start to maybe fray relations a little bit, official relations, if that position is vacant for too long.
Sure. We want to make sure that we have good political relationships with Mexico, particularly the relationships that matter with respect to overall economic trade.
Speaking of political relationships, there has been a lot of talk over the past several months about the relationship in general between the U.S. and Mexico. Does rhetoric on the campaign trail
affect something like trade? I mean, do people in Mexico and businesses say, we're not sure we want to be working with these companies or with this country anymore?
Well, certainly the political climate matters for overall economic trade. And it's one of the things that we want to make sure that we pay attention to is the importance of that trade relationship. So overall, you know, Mexico is an important destination for Arizona's exports. Our exports in 2015 hit $9.2 billion, and that works out to just over $1,300 per person in the state. And that actually ranked Arizona second in the nation in per capita exports to Mexico, behind only Texas.
Have you seen any noticeable difference since the conversation about building the fence on the border, having the Mexican government pay for it, has sort of become part of the dialogue here in this country?
I think that has become part of the dialogue. I'm not sure how seriously that is really taken. But overall, our export performance continues to be fairly strong, particularly here in Arizona. Our exports to Mexico actually rose by just over 6% in 2015, and that was much faster than national performance. So overall, you know, there are a variety of factors that are affecting our overall exports, including what's going on with the value of the U.S. dollar, which is rising and has risen rapidly against the Mexican peso, as well as what's going on directly in the Mexican economy with the major decreases in oil prices over the past year and a half.
Well, you bring up two factors there, and I'm curious, when you're talking about what impacts the amount of trade between two countries, how much of it is factors like the relative value of currency, the relative value of raw materials, and how much of it is political climate, political rhetoric, and sort of politics in general?
Well, politics certainly matters and certainly has an impact, but the fundamentals matter too, and we don't want to lose sight of that. So what's going on with the value of the U.S. dollar can have a big impact on certain types of exports from Arizona, particularly agricultural exports. But you also want to keep in mind that one of our major exports to Mexico is actually tourism expenditures by Mexican visitors. So when Mexican nationals cross the border to shop in Arizona or to visit our resorts, that's actually one form of an export from Arizona to Mexico. And that probably is a bit more sensitive to what's going on with the value of the dollar, particularly for communities that are right along the border. So there are these economic factors that are important to keep track of, as well as what's going on with the overall political climate.
George Hammond is director of the Economic and Business Research Center at the Eller College of Management at the University of Arizona. George, thank you.
Thank you.
It's the show on KJZZ for Tuesday, March 15th. Thanks for listening. Along with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick today, I'm Mark Brody. Russian bombers, transport planes, and fighter jets are all flying back to Russia from Syria as Russian President Vladimir Putin announced a withdrawal of his main forces from Syria.
I think that the task that was put before the Ministry of Defense and the armed forces is largely complete. Therefore, I order the Minister of Defense from tomorrow to begin the withdrawal of the main part of our military from the Syrian Arabic Republic.
So Vladimir Putin's mission accomplished announcement comes amid a new round of peace talks in Geneva between the Syrian government and opposition forces there. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest wasn't exactly sure how to take the news when he learned of it at his daily briefing yesterday.
I haven't seen the reports, so it's hard for me to assess at this point what sort of impact this will have on the talks. So we'll have to see exactly what Russia's intentions are.
For more now on what this all means for the situation in Syria, we turn to Joshua Landis. He's director for the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Joshua Landis, welcome.
Very good to be with you.
Well, we heard a great deal of surprise in Josh Earnest's voice there for nearly everyone involved. Is this Russian for mission accomplished?
Well, it is in a sense. This is an opening gambit to the Geneva negotiations, peace negotiations that just opened yesterday. And in that sense, I think Putin is saying, I'm here to do business. I'm willing to negotiate with you. He needs America to meet him halfway.
So what advantage then going into those talks, if this is an opening gambit, what advantage does it put Putin at as he engages the United States and the other countries in these talks?
Well, he's letting the Syrian opposition know that they're going to have to come up with something. And people have forgotten the Syrian opposition in these negotiations because they're so divided. There are over 1,000 of them. And they've asked for Assad to step down and that there has to be a transitional government. That's never going to happen. Assad is very strong now with Russian backing. And it's also a shot across Assad's bow because Assad has been completely inflexible so far. He thought a week ago that Russia was going to take him all away to reconquer Syria. Today, it's very clear that that's not going to happen. And there's a third, which is a shot across America's bow. Putin wanted, when he went into Syria, to become a partner with America in chasing down ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and in a sense, bringing order to Syria. But he wanted Assad to be that partner with America. And America turned up their nose at that. And I think he's a little bit miffed in these negotiations. And he's saying, I can go home and take my marbles, and you'll be left holding the bag in Syria.
And on the other hand, the message to Assad, he's clearly stronger. He's clearly made gains. Putin has propped him up. Is there a chance that he interprets this as twisting in the wind a little bit militarily and politically for his opening position as these talks get underway?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And you know, nobody has a fix for Syria. We have entered these negotiations with the same old, same old, with the opposition and the United States saying Assad has to go, with Assad and the Russians saying Assad's here to stay. And that has torpedoed three previous negotiation attempts. I think Russia is saying, we don't want this to turn into a quagmire. We've got to think outside of the box. Let's all come to the table and be a little bit more honest here. Now, of course, we don't know how honest Russia is being in this willingness to withdraw troops, but nobody has an answer to Syria. And that's what we're going to find out is how do you think anew about some peace process?
Oil prices, of course, have tanked, and Russia is an oil economy in many ways. So in an economic crisis, is part of this sort of a Russian thrift savings plan, get the forces back in and save on an expensive intervention?
Well, when it comes to the Middle East, everybody thinks oil. And there have been lots of speculation amongst the oil people saying Russia is showing willingness to compromise with Saudi Arabia because they're trying to come to an agreement on lowering oil output to increase prices, and that would help both their economies. I don't believe that oil and the Syria problem are that connected together. I don't think Saudi Arabia and Russia are ready to negotiate over shares of markets. I don't think they're willing to cut their share of the oil market. I think this is strictly about Syria.
Yes, but at the same time, Vladimir Putin has a domestic economic situation. Russia is an oil economy as well. He needs money, and I wonder if he's not saving significantly in his own domestic sense by pulling forces back.
Well, that could be a motivation. He doesn't want to get caught in a quagmire. On the other hand, we'll have to see how many forces he really takes out. He's not going to let his big investment in Assad's regime and in Syria go down the drains in order to save some bucks at home. This is a major foreign policy undertaking. And I think this is a lot of smoke and mirrors. It could become reality if other groups meet him at the table halfway.
Vladimir Putin surprises the world, certainly surprises the people seated around Geneva peace talks, pulls his forces out of Syria, sends his jets home. Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway. Arizona has a big agriculture industry, but Barry Pryor thinks the state is missing out on a big growth opportunity. He's a professor of plant pathology and microbiology in the School of Plant Sciences at the University of Arizona. And along with another guy, he travels around the state conducting workshops teaching people about the economic opportunities in growing specialty mushrooms. Barry Pryor joins me. And Barry, what is the current state of the mushroom growing industry in Arizona?
Well, it's very small.
there are, and I don't have the exact numbers, I estimate that there are probably 15 commercial producers in Arizona, and most of them produce perhaps less than $50,000 a year. Oftentimes, the mushroom production is integrated into a diversified farming system, which means that these producers are also farming other crops.
What do you think is the potential here?
So our numbers that we generate in terms of potential market are based upon U.S. statistics on consumption of mushrooms per capita. And we estimate that there's 4 pounds of specialty mushrooms consumed per capita nationwide. And if we calculate that in the population of the greater Phoenix area, or actually just Phoenix itself, it comes out to almost a $10 million value for specialty mushrooms consumed in Phoenix annually. Now, when I'm talking about specialty mushrooms, I'm speaking of those mushrooms that are other than button mushrooms, portobellos, and crimonies. Those three mushrooms are sort of the mainstay of the mushroom industry worldwide and account for probably 70% of production worldwide. However, the growth in the mushroom industry is really in the specialty mushrooms, and these are the oyster mushrooms, the shiitake, lion's mane, pipinos, more exotic and perhaps more flavorful mushrooms that people are now appreciating.
When you think about mushrooms, they are a fungus. They tend to grow in warm, wet conditions. And while Arizona is certainly warm, it is not often seen as wet or humid. So I would imagine that there are some potential challenges as far as growing mushrooms in the desert.
So we'll make a correction there. Most varieties of commercial mushrooms, whether they be button mushrooms or specialty mushrooms, are grown under cool, wet conditions. And it's true that Arizona, you wouldn't think Arizona might be the spot for growing such a crop because it tends to be warm and dry. But mushrooms worldwide, the majority of mushrooms worldwide, are grown in controlled environment facilities, meaning that they're grown indoors and that we modify the temperature and the humidity and, in the case of mushrooms, the airflow to enable the fungus to produce the fruiting body known as the mushroom.
Well, so, you know, Arizona has a fairly strong industry of greenhouse-grown produce. Is it surprising to you in some ways that we don't do more mushroom growing here?
It is surprising. Now, Arizona does have a very strong industry in controlled environment agriculture, and the University of Arizona has a world-class controlled environment agriculture center. Because we're somewhat unfamiliar with mushrooms, it hasn't really caught on yet in the West that we can use these same facilities or similar facilities that we grow our tomatoes and our cucumbers and our lettuce and our strawberries that we're currently growing in controlled environment facilities. We haven't extended that as fully and optimally as we could to growing mushrooms. Now, and this is surprising for me. Exactly, it is surprising for me. But this is part of our program right now. We're trying to integrate mushroom culture, or we'll say mycoculture, into controlled environment agriculture facilities. And we're trying to do it in perhaps a co-cultivation system in which in one part of the facility you're growing a plant crop which consumes carbon dioxide and releases oxygen, and in the other part of the facility, you grow a fungal crop, a mushroom crop, which consumes oxygen and releases CO2. It's a perfect combination.
Barry Pryor is a professor of plant pathology and microbiology in the School of Plant Sciences at the University of Arizona. We are talking about the potential growth in the mushroom growing industry in the state. Spring training has descended on the Valley. Fans get a chance to see their favorite players up close, and minor leaguers get a chance to prove their worth. The constantly changing lineup is just one challenge public address announcers face in the press box. But as KJZZ's West Valley Bureau reporter Casey Kuhn found, that voice of God usually belongs to some of the biggest baseball fans at the game.
This afternoon's Cactus League baseball game features the Kansas City Royals and your Seattle Mariners.
Kevin Derryberry kicks off a spring training game from the press box at the Peoria Sports Complex. As one of the public address announcers, he gets there a few hours before the first pitch to prepare.
One of the first things you always do is just see what kind of pronunciation challenges you could foresee.
Derry Berry says some teams are better than others with pronouncer lists. He lets me have a crack at one particularly difficult Mariners pitcher name.
Guapi Maykol.
Okay.
Maykol Guapi.
Somewhat close. It's actually Michael Guaype.
Not close.
In my defense, his name is spelled M-A-Y-C-K-O-L. And getting the players' names right is just one challenge, Derry Berry says, comes with the job of announcing spring training games. Jim Vreeke, the more seasoned announcer in Peoria, started volunteering at the complex as a parking lot attendant. When management found out he had a radio background in Seattle, where he retired from before moving to the West Valley, they tapped Vreeke to announce a game after the main guy got sick.
It was a quick learning experience.
That was more than 10 years ago, and he says the toughest part of announcing still is staying ahead of the player changes in a spring training game.
And I always wondered, why doesn't the guy announce that there's a new third baseman, a new second baseman? Well, then I found out why, because wham, you're doing some commercials and there's eight changes and the batter's coming to the batter's box, so there's no time to really get that in.
Vreeke's love of baseball started like many baseball fans do, as part of a family tradition.
My dad was a Cub fan. I grew up in the Midwest. And I remember he'd get his Gettleman beer and go on the porch after supper, as they call it in the Midwest. And we'd listen to the Cub games. And that's how, and he'd keep score. He taught me how to keep score, and I was a baseball fan ever since. And I always think of when I'm at a booth, boy, if my dad had an opportunity to just come to spring training and see something like this.
In another press box over at Glendale's Camelback Ranch, a crew five times the size of Peoria's works graphics and cameras as Jeff Scott rattles off announcements telling the crowd where they're allowed to smoke and to watch out for foul balls. Scott's day job is a news director at a local radio network. He's also announced NBA games and says baseball is less play-by-play and more setup.
In football and basketball, you're announcing the outcome of each and every play. In baseball, it's more a series of introductions. You know, you're getting paid to sound like the voice of God, so you have to do your best to try to make sure you fill that role.
Every year, he still looks forward to this annual gig.
It's a great atmosphere, and they're the same people back here year after year, and they become like your camp friends. If you went to summer camp every year, you'd have your school friends and your camp friends. These are my camp friends.
Those camp friends are what he says make spring training in the Valley such a special occasion.
It's baseball, and baseball is American, and the Cactus League is Arizona, and all of it adds up to one big social party, and that's just continuing to increase each year.
A social party hosted and narrated by PA announcers like Scott Vreeke and Derry Berry.
For Seattle, number 44, Taiwan Walker.
Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Peoria.
In KJZZ News, Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders is in the Valley today holding a rally at the Phoenix Convention Center. As KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, hundreds of people lined up for a spot inside.
The line started forming this morning with some of the first supporters arriving around 10 o'clock. The energy outside the convention center was high as officials began letting people inside for the 6 o'clock rally titled A Future to Believe In. Those in line chanted phrases like feel the burn. Not everyone in the area supported Sanders and his platforms, though. Some passing by in cars called those in the crowd freeloaders. This is Bernie Sanders' second time in the Valley. Today's visit comes a week before Arizona's presidential preference elections. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In a look at international news, locals in northern Peru at the headwaters of the Amazon River have been grappling with the aftermath of a huge oil spill after a trans-Amazonian pipeline fractured. The pipeline dumped some 3,000 barrels of thick black crude into the Jungle River system. The BBC has seen firsthand evidence children have been used to help clean up the spill. Officials from the state-owned oil company denied hiring children to combat the leak. As Wara Davis reports, many locals have also told the BBC they fell ill after helping with the cleanup.
In the pristine rainforests of northern Peru, an environmental disaster is threatening the headwaters of the world's greatest river system. For the last month, workers from Peru's state-controlled petrol company have been mopping up and scooping up almost 500,000 liters of thick crude oil.
It was contaminated, but you can see it's almost clean.
Keen to show us how well the cleanup is going, Victor Palomino from Petroperú denies it was a lack of maintenance that caused the 40-year-old pipeline to break, spilling 3,000 barrels of oil into the river Chiriaco. But he admits it's unlikely to be the last such incident.
Well, we have more accidents. Sometimes it's inevitable, that things, but we are working hard protecting the environment. We are working hard making a good maintenance of the pipeline. But the most important thing here is protect the environment. If you can protect the environment, if you can protect the safety of the community.
In addition to the environmental impact, we came across something equally disturbing in these poor indigenous communities, evidence that children have also been involved in the cleanup. 14-year-old Naith shows me how she and her two younger brothers scooped oil with their bare hands into buckets, paid about a dollar for each one by company officials, she says. They fell ill with fever and diarrhea after being sent to the river to gather oil, says their father Jaime. His middle son, 7-year-old Osman, is still in hospital. Jaime shows me the boy's oil-stained clothes. But Petroperú says it explicitly prohibits the employment of children at the operations center, where it does hire local workers to help in the cleanup. But the company said it would look into the allegations. Well, here on the banks of the Rio Chiriaco, which by now has become a huge river, and there are people here alongside the banks cutting away the oil-stained vegetation. The oil company insists that no expense and no amount of human effort will be spared to clean up this spill within a month. But the effects will last much longer. There's a state of emergency here, which means that locals, and indigenous people in particular, can't use the river or fish in it for at least 4 months. And this is a river upon which their very lives depend. It's a disaster for the community, Elamina tells me in her native Achuar language, showing me the fishing nets stained black with oil. With part of their land now contaminated, locals say oil has brought nothing but trouble to this region. Richard Chase Smith is an environmental campaigner who has worked with these communities for years.
It's collusion between the government and oil companies. And they don't have the money for social responsibility programs. They don't have money for cleanups. In that sense, it's the state's responsibility to make sure that they're complying even with the weakened environmental regulation. And these spills are happening because the infrastructure is so old and there has been no investment. And it's the state company, oil company, that has to make that investment to keep up its infrastructure.
Oil and water do not mix. That much is known. And locals here say their environment cannot tolerate many more spills of this kind.
That's the BBC's Wura Davis. Arizona leaders spend a lot of time talking about how the state can lure businesses here, especially from California, based on our tax structure. But new research from the Tax Foundation finds Arizona's combined state and average local sales tax rate is only slightly lower than California's. Jared Walczak is a policy analyst at the Tax Foundation. He looks at state tax policy. Jared, how important are sales taxes to states?
Sales taxes are a very important part of state and often local revenue because they are fairly stable, often much more so than income taxes, both individual and corporate. Often they are a significant source of revenue after property taxes for local governments, making them uniquely important because frequently local governments have limited tools available to them, especially compared to states, for raising revenue.
When businesses are looking to move or relocate, obviously, taxes are a big part of that. Are sales taxes a big part of that as well?
probably more so in Arizona than in most states, because an ideally structured sales tax is going to fall on all final consumer transactions, ideally both goods and services, although most states do not include most services in the base, but they would not include business inputs. And the reason for that is not to give a benefit to business. It's because when you tax business inputs, you're taxing at multiple stages along the production process, and this means that those rates get embedded multiple times in that final good or service. You're paying multiple times for it. And Arizona has that more than most because the transaction privilege tax, what we generally call the Arizona sales tax, is a little more like a gross receipts tax, and it has differential rates on a range of different taxable activities, many of them business activities. So you have these high rates on business activities, businesses that aren't able to bring everything in-house and instead have these longer production chains are getting hit relatively hard by the Arizona sales tax in a way they wouldn't be in most states. And that's certainly a concern to a lot of businesses.
Well, so given that, you know, there's a lot of emphasis here on trying to recruit businesses to expand in Arizona or relocate to Arizona, and a lot of elected leaders are specifically looking west to California, where the common line is taxes are so high there, regulation is so high there that Arizona is a logical place for them to come. But based on your research, it looks like Arizona and California are very, very close to each other as far as sales tax.
They are. Arizona has the 11th highest combined state and local rate. California has the 10th highest. So it's a little higher, but not much. And when you consider the breadth of the base in Arizona and how many more business inputs that are included in that base, Arizona's sales tax is probably worse for many businesses than California's. Now, there are many other aspects about the California tax system where Arizona has a significant advantage. But on sales tax, there's no real advantage here for Arizona.
So I guess what role then does that play as far as efforts to try to bring businesses specifically from California, because that's been a big emphasis here? Does that hurt the effort to bring businesses from California to Arizona?
It can absolutely hurt that effort. And it also means a lot of non-neutral treatment, because every county is able to set its own rates. In fact, at state, county, municipal level, you have all of these different taxes, and they can be set on different taxable activities at different rates.
I'm curious about another aspect of the state's economy, which is visitation and tourism. That's obviously a very big component of the economy here. Sales tax is something that anybody who comes here pays. Is this something that visitors look at? I mean, do they care when they're planning their vacation? Like, does sales tax outweigh the fact that it's 70 degrees and sunny here in the wintertime?
Probably not nearly as much. You know, when a business is making this decision, they're doing a lot of calculations because this is a huge deal for them. For a visitor, it can make some difference, especially, say, with taxes on hospitality. Not that necessarily the taxpayer notices what the taxes are, but, you know, they go onto Expedia and they're looking at their different hotels and they notice this one's $8 cheaper than that one, and they don't understand that it's across a county line, but that can make a difference, perhaps. But it's not a coincidence that the highest combined rate you find in Arizona is 10.9% in Fredonia, which is the gateway to the Grand Canyon, because you're probably going to the Grand Canyon, whether or not the sales tax is 10.9% there. You're probably going to buy a souvenir, and you're probably going to buy a map, and you know, you can get away with it, and you have that sales tax exporting to you know, those visiting as tourists from out of state. But of course, Arizonans have to pay this as well, and it's a very high rate in some cases on a great deal of activity. So for every dollar you're getting in exporting, how much damage are you doing to your own state's economy?
Jared Walczak is a policy analyst at the Tax Foundation. We're talking about the relative sales tax rates across the country and in Arizona. Jared, thank you very much.
All right, thank you for having me.
If you're a big fan of the Summer Olympics, you've probably watched a few field hockey games. Well, the game of taco looks pretty similar on the surface, but the show's Anika Klein tells us it has its roots in Tohono O'odham culture.
It's game time in Sacatone on the Gila River Reservation. A group of taco players gears up. They each choose a stick, called an usaga, from a pile. Someone picks up a puck, the ola.
One on this side! Come on this side, one of
you! You can't find these items in a store. They're handmade out of mesquite, just like they have been for generations. And the matches are intense.
And it's really aggressive, and we get tired, we have a lot of bumps and bruises, but it's all worth it.
Summer Narcho has been playing taka since she was 9 years old. She's 32 now. Her team is from Cells, capital of the Tohono O'odham Nation, and they're out here today for a taka tournament.
A lot of people's games are basketball or volleyball or softball, but my game is taka.
AKA teams exist across the Tohono O'odham Nation and also in the Gila River and Salt River communities. And they're all ages. But when Angelina Serafisio started playing taka in the 60s, it looked a little different.
The kids weren't, I guess, allowed to play. They never played at that time.
Taka was always a game for the women in the community. Serafisio used to play with staff members at the elementary school where she taught. But the pastime was fading.
We did need to bring it back at that time because there were only like three teams that we were always playing against. And there weren't any more teams. And all the ladies that were on those teams were elderly.
So Serafisio started a team of girls through a Girl Scout troop. That was about 40 years ago. Now, tournaments like this one fill up with players of all ages. Jennifer Allison is the oldest member of a relatively new team from Gila River. She says the wide age range provides balance to the team.
The younger ones can emulate the older ones, but of course the older ones would also depend on the younger ones, being that they're younger are probably faster runners. Go, go, go!
Today, the girls have other sports to choose from at school or at rec centers. Serafisia says she still plays softball, but there's something special about this game. Taka is a part of tribal legend, played by O'odham women for as long as anyone can remember.
That gives them that identity that I am Tohono O'odham, I am an O'odham, I am of this certain tribe that used to play this game, and I'm carrying it on.
Carrying on a cultural tradition, something best described in Summer Narcho's team motto.
It says pain is temporary and cultural pride is forever.
For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
And now for a tiny desert concert. That's when we bring local bands into the KJZZ studios to play a couple of songs for us and talk a bit about the music. Today we hear from Kais Isar. Kais is one of eight acts from Arizona playing in this year's South by Southwest Festival in Austin. He plays a unique fusion of Eastern and Western music using an Afghan stringed instrument called the rabab. Steve Goldstein talked with Kais about his instrument and distinct style.
The rabab is origins from Central Asia. It's considered to be the national instrument of Afghanistan. That's where I'm from. The instrument itself has been dated as far back as, I'd say, 2,500 to 3,000 years old. And it's a lute instrument made from primarily three pieces of wood. The skin is made from a goat string. And we traditionally are supposed to play on strings made from intestine, gut. So I opt for nylon because I figure that's easier to find. And I don't know, I figure intestine would start to smell like beef jerky after a while if you play it for a while. So
so fusion in the past, for some, when they think about jazz fusion, could sound like, yeah, kind of a pejorative, not a great word. In your case, when you're fusing, what are you fusing? What do you want the final product to be?
Yeah, see, I hate the word fusion too. It's such like a, I don't know, but it's, I mean, for lack of a better term, an amalgamation, right? So, you know, you kind of forget that, you know, you have, you're mixing two different traditions. It's just presented as one new, you know, at this time, genreless, but, you know, nevertheless, a new type of sound.
So, Kais, the reason you're here is to play a song for us. What are you going to play?
I'm going to play the single from my first LP entitled Transmutation.
Do you feel a kind of pressure when you're melding these sorts of sounds together, especially one that has a very old tradition, and then one could argue that it sounds in some ways the style that people could be more used to in a current sense? I mean, you're really trying to put together two different sounds, and yet it seems to come out comfortably with you and what your band members do.
Well, yeah, I mean, what I'm trying to do is preserve this instrument, so provide a vehicle for it to come into the 21st century. Because especially from a lot of these older oral traditions, a lot of stuff kind of becomes lost over the generations. And so such a beautiful instrument with such a beautiful timbre and sound should be enjoyed by a whole other generation. And I'm hoping that by mixing it with other types of music and by presenting it in a different way, that this music not only survives, not only the instrument, but hopefully a renewed interest in the East, as far as looking at it as a place of art, as a place of music and culture.
So, Cass, let's talk going cross-cultural here. When we think about Eastern and Western, and what goes into that, and how do you feel about that as someone who is approaching it from the standpoint of a musician? Do you like the heft of that idea of bringing these different cultures together?
I think it's the responsibility of anyone that commands such an audience to be able to do something with it. And my goals, aside from, you know, what I want to do musically, I also have my own, like, sociopolitical agenda, and that's showing people that really aren't used to seeing the more positive aspects of just my culture, right? So just, you know, let's focus on Afghanistan. Over the past 40 to 50 years, there's been just, you know, turmoil and war. I would love it in 5 years when someone says the word Afghanistan, not to immediately associate it with, like, Taliban or immediately associate it with terrorism. I would love if it was like someone said Afghanistan, like, oh, the place with awesome music or awesome food or awesome people. And all of that is true.
And Kais, why don't you take us out on a song?
Not a problem. I will play a little bit more of a traditional piece. It's a rag, rag Shirvanjani, and I'm just going to do a brief improv. Thank you.
That was Steve Goldstein speaking with local musician Kais Issar, who will be playing at South by Southwest in Austin this week. You can follow KJZZ's coverage of South by Southwest by visiting kjzz.org/sxsw. You can see video of this and other Tiny Desert concerts by visiting kjzz.org/tinydesertconcert. And if you're in a band or know of one you'd like to hear play a Tiny Desert concert, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.